Good morning, everyone. 10:30 having arrived, and pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I'm calling Mr. McCarrick of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. To begin with, the CLA will take the roll to determine which members are present.
Chair Gomez.
Present.
Gomez present. Keeler. New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley present. Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins. Hornstein.
Present.
Hornstein present. Howard.
Present.
Howard present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Present.
Ryer present. Keeler.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Clerk. Next, we're going to approve the minutes. Last week, Representative Davids joined us just a couple minutes late, but the minutes reflect that he was present. Does anyone want to offer a motion to approve the minutes for January 27th, 2021?
I'll move.
Representative Hornstein moves approval of the minutes for January 27th, 2021. Any discussion? Hearing none, if you could unmute for a moment, we'll take a voice vote. And all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for January 27th, 2021 are approved. So we have two bills before us today, members. First, we're going to hear House File 21. This bill was referred to this division by the chair of the full committee, Representative Schultz. And I'll move that House File 21 be referred back to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Hassan, are you ready to go?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Great. Please tell us about your bill, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for taking up House File 21, the Emergency Shelter Housing Funding Proposal. The purpose of this legislation is to help a large gap around the state emergency housing funding for those who are unhoused. As you may recall from the past few years, the lack of temporary shelter has hit unhoused Minnesotans hard in a high profile. In 2018, more than 200 people created a small tent city in Minneapolis called the Wall of Forgotten Natives to draw attention to this serious and persistent problem. In November of 2019, a public housing apartment fire in Minneapolis, Cedar Riverside neighborhood, killed five people and left many families unhoused and in need of emergency shelters. Followed by the Drake Hotel fire, this temporary shelter was seriously damaged by fire in the early morning of Christmas of 2019, putting about 250 people and dozens of families out in the cold winter streets. In 2021, the year 2021 has been a year filled with uncertainties. The pandemic has exacerbated the inequities and highlighted all of our systemic flaws, especially in housing. When the governor ordered a shelter in place, there were plenty of our community members who didn't have a place to stay. After the murder of George Floyd, followed by the civil unrest, we had a large group of unhoused folks staying at Powderhorn Park. At one point, we had almost every Minneapolis park occupied by unhoused folks. As some of you might or might not know, my family immigrated from Somalia. And when we left my homeland, we stayed at the refugee camp. I don't know if any of you guys have seen a refugee camp. It's all tents. And every time I see the tents, in Minneapolis that people are sleeping, it takes me back, 10-year-old me, in staying at the refugee camp. there is no reason why our folks, you know, in a state that has ample of resources, we should have folks sleeping outside in tents because we're not putting resources in the right place. And sadly, Madam Chair, this is the tip of the iceberg. The need for funding in emergency shelters is urgent, and the need is in communities big and small and across the state. With House File 21, we're asking an appropriation of $25 million to increase the supply and improve the conditions of our emergency shelters. And with that, I have some testifiers who are going to share, you know, their stories and highlight this need in a much larger way. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Representative Hassan. We appreciate you bringing this bill before the committee. I understand we have two testifiers joining us. Can I call in Rose Surma to go first? Are you here, Rose?
Yes, I am here. Oops.
Great. Thank you for joining us, Ms. Surma. If you could identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, Chair Gomez and committee members. My name is Rose Surma, and I am the executive director for a nonprofit organization, Oasis Central Minnesota. And we provide food and housing resources in Morrison County, Minnesota. For those of you that don't know, it's located in central rural Minnesota. Currently, our organization is the only emergency shelter provider in the county, as well as nearly all except for one of the surrounding counties. Additionally, there is no women's shelter located in our county, so we are often providing shelter for those fleeing family violence. Our agency currently provides emergency shelter in a motel setting, as well as new this year, shelter in a duplex apartment building. While the motel setting has provided an immediate and flexible option, there are challenges to both the setting. If you can imagine a family of one adult and four children spending 60 days in a motel room, unable to prepare meals, even store a gallon of milk, not to mention having separate quiet space, as well as the cost efficiency of utilizing the motel. There are also additional challenges with the motel, including vacancy and motel regulations, even something as simple as need for photo ID. In fact, 2 years ago, we had a family of four that came into our office on a January morning. A job loss in the family had led to an eviction, and they had nowhere to go. I was told there were no immediate vacancies in any of the area motels. And I just, explaining to anyone that you have no way to shelter them is truly heartbreaking. This family was faced with the decision of sleeping in their vehicle or attempting to make it to the shelter more than 30 miles away in an unreliable vehicle and only gas money for one way. What I will also remember personally about this situation that just deeply touched me, that afternoon while I was waiting to pick up my children from school, there also waiting for their children was this family that I had just tried to help. And it just really, it made me think, I can't imagine of the fear, anxiety, and hopelessness that you'd feel picking up your children from school and not knowing where you would sleep, what you would eat, or how you would shower or use a bathroom. Our organization has been working to build our capacity to meet these community needs, which this year has led to acquiring a duplex that we are using for emergency shelter with a length of stay from between 30 to 90 days, while tenants work to connect to community resources and transition to stable permanent housing. In fact, we actually had to open our doors about 45 days early. It was a whirlwind of cleaning and furnishing and piecing together a home, as we had a family of one adult and five children needing emergency shelter due to domestic violence, and their family size could not be accommodated in a motel. Their alternative without this duplex, where they spent one night prior to being referred to our organization, was sleeping in their van in the school parking lot. While this duplex has allowed this and future families to feel safe, stable, and gives a feeling of home, and is more efficient than the motel, the need for more shelter is greater than even our expanded resources. We need, as well as others across the state, access to funding to build shelter capital that will accommodate each unique community. And I really want to stress that it's more than just a building and a structure. It's really building a strong workforce, strong and stable families, and just building community. Shelter saves lives. Housing ends homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Surma, and for your good work. Next, we have David Fry. Not sure if I'm saying your name right, sir.
Yep, that is correct. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is David Fry. I'm the Executive Director for Family Promise in Anoka County. I also want to say thank you to Ms. Surma for her story. Her story is our story as well. We have families that are living in cars and children who are living in places that are unsafe for habitation. And Family Promise in Anoka County started 10 years ago when political, business, and faith leaders in our community came together to look for solutions to a growing problem in our suburban community, children and their families experiencing homelessness. For 10 years, we've used a rotation of faith communities to provide the evening shelter and the meals for families up to three at a time. And using this rotation has allowed us to bring people into a safe space and to help them move toward housing independence. But the model has its downsides. For many families, the constant moving is difficult to fit in with their job and their school schedules, adding stress and exhaustion to a very difficult time in their lives. It's also limited in scope and only scratches the surface of the problem. Many more families need help than we're able to serve, and we're the only non-DV family shelter program in our community. We get an average of 10 calls for service a week, and we're able to serve three families at a time. Many of those families are in our program for 90 days or more. For this reason, 3 years ago, our board of directors began the process of working toward creating a permanent family shelter in Anoka County. This space would be better equipped to meet the needs of the families and to allow us to double the number of families we could serve at one time and to move toward better outcomes for those families. But the progress is slow. The support and the need are both present in the community for a larger, more stable shelter opportunity for families. We've met with city and county leaders, business leaders, and have developed a partnership with a local congregation that will provide the space and the land that we need. We've met with an architect to begin planning for the space and have been moving down that road for the last year. However, while many community partners allow us to be sustainable in the work we do, the funding needed to build the necessary shelter space is much larger than our regular supporters can handle. To take the step of creating a true family shelter will take capital support, which can take a long time to raise, and takes energy and resources away from the important work that we're already doing. During the coronavirus pandemic, we've had the opportunity to transition to using hotels, much like Ms. Surma has done as well. And this has allowed us to continue serving families, even to serve more families than we had in the past ever before. However, it's also shown us just how difficult it is to sustain that congregational rotation throughout a pandemic or for other reasons as well. A permanent shelter would allow us to continue to serve more families, at least double what we've been able to do in the past and with that congregational rotation. The faster we can get the facility up and running, the faster we'll be able to serve more families and get them into permanent, stable housing, because we know shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. Across the state, there are many organizations in similar situations to ours, trying desperately to help a growing number of people outside the urban core who are struggling against housing instability. For too many, the opportunity of starting in a safe space shelter just isn't an option. We need to increase our shelter capacity across the state in rural and suburban areas as well. Many organizations like Family Promise and our community partners are ready to take the step, but we need the help with capital funding to make it happen. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony, and thank you, Representative Hassan, for inviting these folks to support your proposal in front of us. We've received some written testimony on this bill, which has been posted to the committee page and shared with members via email, so I hope you guys have had a chance to check that out. Also, we have a couple of public testifiers who've signed up to speak about this bill. First, we're going to hear from Kathy Tenbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to be here today. Both of the bills before you today really address the important gaps that our homeless response system continues to have across the state. And I know you all know, and certainly you have heard us talk about this already in this committee, that homelessness in and of itself, of course, is a critically urgent issue. It has never been more urgent than this past year. To act quickly to help protect people experiencing homelessness. They are highly vulnerable to the impact of COVID due to age, multiple underlying health conditions, and as we've talked about before, the very settings that so many people find them in that are very congregate and crowded makes protecting themselves from COVID very, very difficult. The data that we have since COVID has hit has really underscored that vulnerability. The rates of hospitalization and ICU for people experiencing homelessness are much higher than for the general population of people who are impacted or affected by COVID. In fact, people experiencing homelessness are 7 times more likely to end up in the ICU if they get COVID. Always important every single time to talk about the inequity we see in people experiencing homelessness. And just for example, American Indians are 27 times more likely to be homeless than white Minnesotans and 31 times more likely to be without shelter at all. And as Representative Hassan said so well at the beginning, you know, people, when COVID hit in Minnesota and Minnesotans were urged to stay at home, of course, people experiencing homelessness quite literally had almost nowhere to be in the community, and the settings themselves, as you mentioned, really needed to be decompressed and spread out. So the community acted quickly, the state acted quickly. And so what we did with state and federal dollars during this past year is working with local partners all across the state to create over 2,800 temporary shelter options that were safe for COVID, typically hotel, motel type locations, covered staffing, provided food and PPE, contracted with hotels, staffing agencies, and food supports to set up isolation spaces for people who had no other place to isolate if they were infected with COVID. We partnered with local governments and nonprofits to create additional shelter capacity for people who were sleeping outside. And we invested in the housing support program to promote COVID-safe congregate settings and to implement a hotel-to-home model to get people out of the hotels we'd set up into permanent housing whenever we possibly could. The bottom line is the need remains to really be able to sustain all of this work that has been established over this past year. I know you know federal funds from the CARES Act have mostly been committed or depleted, and certainly that first tranche of the coronavirus relief funds ended at the end of December. And just to be really clear, the recent federal stimulus, while enormously important to address COVID around vaccines and testing and other items, did not have anything in it that will help support shelters or people sleeping outside during the pandemic. And so a significant need remains to sustain what we've established. So essentially the outline of the response, the three-legged piece of the stool that both of these bills are really talking about, they're each talking about, is to sustain our emergency services program. And once again, that's the shelter capacity, the staffing, the hygiene, the food, the protective equipment, to bolster our housing support settings in their ongoing work to comply with the COVID guidance to keep everybody safe, and then to support the need for the isolation spaces that we have set up already to sustain it and be prepared also in case there would be new outbreaks and the need for additional space. I do want to just also note it's important that the governor has proposed critical investments to address homelessness in his budget, and this includes ongoing investments in the emergency services program, additional funding for counties and tribes to support that integration of housing services and their human services work, and stable funding for the Homeless Management Information System, which is our data system that we use to really drive results for people experiencing homelessness. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, just for the opportunity to speak to the need that these bills, the gaps that both these bills help fill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Director Tenbrook. Next, we have Sue Wetlove Phillips joining us. Ms. Wetlove Phillips, if you're here, if you could identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and committee members, Sue Wetlove Phillips, and thank you for the opportunity to testify. I think I'm testifying possibly twice today, one on follow-up on last week's testimony and on these bills. Would you like me to combine all of that together, or would you like me to do those separately, Chair Gomez?
Thank you. So Ms. Wetlove Phillips was signed up for public testimony last week or the week before, and we ran out of time. So we wanted to give you some time kind of to share that general story that you wanted to share with us last week or the week before. But if you could combine your comments on the two bills that are before us, and then in between the two bills, we'll give you more time to share your story.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Sue Watlow-Phillips, Executive Director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President of the National Coalition for the Homeless. MICA supports the capital funds for emergency shelters to help rehab and acquire buildings for 24-hour emergency shelters. This is a critical need, as has already been talked about, in regards to having a place where people can be 24 hours a day. In 1984, we passed legislation in Minnesota that had resources to help with the acquisition and rehab of shelters and transitional housing. Those programs were folded into the Minnesota Housing Trust Fund in the early 2000s and have not been available for doing 24-hour shelters. In 1986, when we passed on the federal level the Emergency Shelter Grants, ESG, now called the Emergency Solution Grants, these dollars were designated for major rehab and direct services, but not allowed for actually acquisition. So some communities did use some of their CARES funding last year to actually rehab buildings and buy buildings. We did that in Hennepin County and other communities across the state that they're using for shelter in COVID-19, but certainly not enough to meet the needs of all the sheltering needs that we have across the state. We hope that as you look at this bill that you will see it as a priority and that you'll also look at ways that we can make sure that people that are experiencing homelessness themselves can create self-governed types of shelter and that we're ensuring that all the shelters abide by a Shelter Residents Bill of Rights and that people who have experienced homelessness are on their governing boards, their board of directors and staff so that we have people that are experiencing homelessness at the decision-making tables. As has been noted in regards to Representative Howard's bill, obviously we need to have the isolation space and the quarantine space for folks that are becoming, that are homeless, that need to be isolated because of the COVID-19. As Kathy Timbrook just identified, we have much higher rates of folks that struggle and end up in the hospital and in ICU that experience homelessness and also have tested positive for the COVID-19. So I look forward to spending a little bit more time with you later on in this committee hearing to talk a little bit more about the corrections and the COVID-19 response on the state level. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, now is the time for any discussion, comments, or questions you have on the bill in general or for any of the testifiers. Mr. Clerk, does anybody have their hand up? I can't see anyone. Oh, Representative Petersburg.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all the testifiers, and thank you so much for all the work that you do in dealing with the aftermath of homelessness. And it is one of the, I think somebody's used the leg of the stool, but I think really in essence there are two issues that have to be dealt with homeless. First of all, is once somebody finds themselves homeless, to provide shelter for them, which I think these two bills certainly deal with. The other side, of course, is how they became homeless. And so I will share my definition of someone who's homeless, I think, is someone who has the inability to provide a home for themselves. And so the question to the committee, not to the committee, but to the testifiers is, all the stories that you've heard, and I know that you do because I was a church administrator and we had them at church as well, we hear stories about situations, decisions, and stuff that caused them to be homeless or lost their home. And so my question to everybody is, understanding some of those, what options do we have to help people not get to the point where they lose their home or no longer have shelter? What is it that we can do to help make help individuals make decisions that might be helpful in preventing homelessness to begin with? Because otherwise, what's going to happen is we can provide shelter, but at the end of that, they are still without the ability to provide a home for themselves. So we need to get to the point where they can actually start providing homes for themselves as well. Otherwise, our clientele, shall we say, continues to grow. So if anybody has some insight, that would sure be helpful.
Thank you so much for the question, Representative Petersburg. Do any of the testifiers have a comment on that really important question about kind of like root causes?
Madam Chair. This is Sue Watlow Phillips. Thank you.
Yes, please proceed.
Representative, you may have remembered a couple of weeks ago, I talked about the 10 major reasons why people are experiencing homelessness, and we have 5 decades of growing homelessness, which I'll talk a little bit more about in just a couple of minutes. But the major reasons people are homeless is that one is they don't have enough money for housing, or the housing that they have is not affordable, and they may have a number of other issues that they're also trying to deal with. So I think a couple things that we need to do is make sure that we have livable incomes, which includes both wages as well as our different types of public assistance. And then we need to have housing that is affordable. In addition to that, it's important that we have folks that are in school learning how to budget their money, landlord-tenant law, and how to make sure that they are not getting in trouble with credit cards, are just some real quick answers to those questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watlow Phillips. Do any of the other testifiers have any comment to share in response to Rep. Petersburg's question? Go ahead.
I believe I see Rosa's hand is up.
Okay. Sorry, Rose?
Madam Chair. Wanted to sort of comment just for our organization, and I know for many others, the shelter piece is just a part of what we provide. We have on staff case managers and social workers that work to connect people with community resources and coordinate across different support services. So that is an important piece that is part of the shelter option. Another piece to what we do is many families that we work with aren't yet homeless but are very housing insecure. So we do provide services to try and either help them maintain that housing if it seems like it's sustainable, or to find a more affordable option. So thank you for bringing that up. Those are very important pieces to the work that we do.
Thank you very much for that. Rep. Petersburg, did you have any further comments or follow-up question?
Yeah, if I could. You know, I understand that a lot of this has to do with our ability to provide the funding and so forth for housing, and sometimes that gets to be a little bit touchy. But isn't there also a responsibility for each individual to have the skill sets available for a livable wage as well? And that certainly has a responsibility of the individual. Some are going to need a lot more help in achieving that, but to just throw out the fact that everybody needs a livable wage, of course that's true. It depends also on what level of living you want also, but I just think it's important for us to take into consideration that all of us need to take to be helpful of people around us, to help them learn to grow and be self-sufficient as well. So thank you, Madam Chair. That's all I have.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg. I guess just for some context, I do think that it's important to kind of identify what the interplay is between, you know, people's choices and the economic realities that people in our country are facing, which is really one of stagnating wages, that if the minimum wage had kept up with inflation from the level that it was set at in the 1960s, it would be in the mid $20s per hour. Instead, it's at $7.25 nationally. We have a higher minimum wage here. But, you know, I totally hear what you're saying, but I think that there is like this, there's an interplay, right, between people's choices and people's responsibility and the realities that people are facing in terms of things that they cannot change, which are things like stagnating wages, a real increase in housing costs, et cetera. So we're going to continue to have that conversation in this space. So I appreciate that. Next, we had just quickly, Representative Hassan is joining us today. She has another bill in another committee to hear. So if we could keep this part relatively short, and then we'll have more time for conversation after we hear Representative Howard's bill, I think that will be kind of more expansive. So if anybody who has their hand up now could like go after we hear our second bill, if they don't have a question that's specific to Representative Hassan, that would be great. If you do, please do proceed. So I'm just going to call on the folks who have hands up right now. So Representative Heinrich, I believe you're next.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering that the federal COVID funds that came in and some state dollars, maybe there's a breakdown of what has gone to shelters, what money's been maybe set aside for that and spent already. I'm not sure who exactly to ask for that question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Actually, we were going to have kind of, based on some thoughts that I'd had and that Representative New Brindley had, we were going to have a financial kind of overview this week, but we had these bills referred to us. So I think we're going to get more into that. I think that's important. I know that Director Tenbrook is on this call and her team sort of pulling that together. So I would imagine they don't have that right in front of them. Maybe they do, but if not, I think our plan is to hear that kind of like financial overview next week, if not, if we don't have bills to take up. But Ms. Tenbrook or Director Tenbrook, I don't know if you have any comment about Representative Heinrich's question.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gomez. Yes, we do plan to present that information, not just about the COVID funds, but actually more the homeless response in the state writ large. So happy to do that. At a future meeting.
Great, thank you so much. And we'll definitely get back to that, Representative Heinrich. Thank you so much for bringing it up. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hassan. I just have a couple of questions about the bill itself. My first question would just be, There is a set aside that a portion of the funds will be set aside for tribes. I'm wondering why there's no guarantee of a statewide distribution. Typically, when we allocate funds, we like to make sure that that those funds are distributed throughout the state. And I know, and I apologize that I have forgotten names. I've been multitasking during committee. But I know we had someone from Morrison County and people from around the state. But I'm wondering why there's no guarantee that these funds will not be distributed statewide.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. I will ask SAC to just address this.
Thanks, Representative Hassan, Chair Gomez. My name is Zach Eichten. I'm the Public Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless. Representative New Brindley, thank you for the question. One thing that we really wanted to make sure when this bill was being drafted was that we really called out that tribes need to be eligible, because otherwise there are questions on if tribes are eligible for some pots of money. This is definitely meant to be a statewide pot of money. And the reason why we didn't call it out specifically that it needs to be statewide is that was implied in the language was our understanding. I will say, just for some context as to why we thought that way, is that 80 of our 87 counties currently don't have enough beds to meet the need. So this is absolutely a statewide pot of money. Homelessness looks different in different parts of the state, so we didn't want to be too prescriptive in how we laid this out.
Thank you, Mr. Eichten. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Eichten, for that response. I do still have pretty significant concerns that it's not spelled out, that there would be some kind of statewide distribution. Representative Hassan, I'm wondering if you also know, this is specifically for short-term housing facilities. I'm wondering if maybe, I don't know, Representative Hassan, if you are the appropriate person to answer the question as the author, or if one of the other testifiers, but do we know typically how long individuals or families make use of the short-term housing facilities as opposed to the, before they are moved either through their own volition into more stable housing or through longer term housing supports? Do we know how long people are needing these short term programs on average?
Thank you. I wonder if Rep. Hassan or possibly one of the testifiers might have some info to share about that. sure it varies widely depending on a lot of different factors, but maybe someone can give us an idea.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative New-Brenly. I think, and anybody else can chime in, I think it depends on the availability of, you know, supportive housing or affordable housing, whatever avenue they're leaving this temporary shelters. It depends on what resources are available, and it looks different at, you know, different parts of the state. Anybody else want to chime in? Go ahead.
Chair Gomez and Representative New-Brenly, this is Zach Eichten again. The average, according to the HMIS, is 74 days folks use short-term housing and shelter. And that's statewide.
Thank you very much for that. Representative New-Brenly?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. That was a very concise answer. That was exactly what I was looking for, so I appreciate that. And then the question would be, what typically happens when they're in this short-term housing? Are there wraparound supports that help move them then towards long-term housing? Do the majority of these folks move from that short-term housing into another? As we know, the state is certainly not the only player in this space. So what typically happens with those folks when they move from the short term into something else? How do we get them to move? That's really the question. How do we move folks out of the short term housing into another solution?
Thank you, Representative. I wonder if Mr. Eichten wants to take that one as well.
Yes, I'd be thankful to. Thank you, Chair Gomez and Representative New-Brenly. The question of what is available for services is a great question. And a lot of what the services that the state is able to fund comes from the Emergency Services Program statute. It's really, really well thought out statute, really flexible. It provides things like employment services and transportation so that folks can use transportation to get to a job interview, stuff like that. It's a really great statute written really well for local needs. Unfortunately, the base funding for that program is so low that a lot of what shelters are able to provide aren't those really great wraparound services that get folks moving on from shelter very quickly. That's why funding like in House File 42 is really, really critical, as well as some other House files that are out there that we'll be hearing in other committees soon, to focus on getting more funding into that program so that we can get those services that you're referencing, like employment services, into the shelters and actually provide them on a consistent and long-term basis.
Thank you, Mr. Eichten. Representative New-Brenly?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Eichten. My last question would be for Representative Hassan, and I'm a little concerned that the language in the bill is pretty loose, and I'm wondering what is intended when we say increase the supply. Are we talking about building new spaces? Are we talking about acquiring space, existing space somehow? Or, you know, adding on to shelter space? What are we talking when we say increase the supply? And I would also ask, you know, improve the condition. Is there something specific in mind for that already? What's the intention with those items?
Thank you, Representative New-Brenly. I wonder if Rep. Hassan has a response. Also, on the increasing shelter capacity, Director Tenbrook might be able to help us out too, because there's sort of certain ways to think about that. Rep. Hassan?
It's my understanding that, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative New-Brenly. It's my understanding that we're improving, the spaces that we have. We're rehabbing the spaces that we have. It's not my understanding that we're building new shelters, but I am more than happy to ask Zach or anyone else to take this one, but it's my understanding that the shelters were increasing the beds, possibly. That's what the increasing supply means, and then improving the conditions. Some of these spaces are old; they might need some rehab. but I will ask Zach to also chime in.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Fasan and Chair Gomez. Representative New Brindley, yes, that is the general concept here, is that it would be for construction of new spaces, acquisition of spaces that could serve as shelter so that we can reduce construction costs, as well as rehabilitation of existing shelter spaces to make sure that the conditions that people are sheltering in are safe, safe and accessible. So there's a lot of shelters who might need a new roof or might need to replace some windows to make sure that, you know, insulation and whatnot works well in the spaces. So we're trying to increase the supply through that construction and acquisition piece, but also making sure that our existing shelters are able to continue to operate safely.
Thank you. We're probably going to have to just wrap this section up if we can to get Rep. Hassan to her committee. Representative New Brindley, did you have any final comments or thoughts you want to share?
Thank you so much, Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to just offer a closing thought. I do have other questions I would ask. You know, I mean, I know that Bethesda has now been acquired by Ramsey County to increase shelter space. So it would be interesting to know if any of these funds will be used retroactively to help support things like that. But I guess that I would just say I certainly understand the intention of the bill. I appreciate that. I'm really concerned about how loose the language is, and I'm especially concerned about a lack of ensuring a statewide distribution on this. I'm going to vote no on this today, but I hope that those issues will be addressed as this moves forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Seeing no other questions before the committee, I'm sorry, you guys, I'm having trouble finding my document. Hold on.
Madam Chair, Rep. Ryer has a question. She's her hand up. Sorry.
We're actually going to just hold Representative Ryer's question and get you to committee. I'd like to renew my motion to re-refer this House file to the Health and Human Services Finance, or the Human Services Finance Division. I'm sorry, can you hold on just a moment? Okay, sorry, y'all, I lost my spot. Hearing no further discussion, I'm renewing my motion that House File 21 be referred back to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. The committee legislative assistant will take the role if he could proceed.
Chair Gomez.
Aye.
Keeler.
Aye.
Keeler, aye. New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley, nay. Davids.
Davids, no.
Davids, nay. Heinrich.
Heinrich, no.
Heinrich, nay. Hollins.
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg.
No.
Petersburg, nay. Ryer.
Ryer, aye.
Ryer, aye. There are 7 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 4 nays, the motion passes, and House File 21 is on its way back to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Thank you so much, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, everyone.
Absolutely. So next, as I said, we're going to hear briefly the testimony from Sue Watlow Phillips that she was unable to offer to us a couple weeks ago. So you have 3 to 5 minutes of testimony. You can proceed with that as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, Sue Watlow Phillips, Executive Director of MICA, which is the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing, and President of the National Coalition for the Homeless. I also am Technical Assistance Consultant to the U.S. Department of HUD, Housing and Urban Development, in the development of the COVID-19 vaccine policies for people experiencing homelessness. We also assisted in the development of the Second Chance Coalition been working with people experiencing homelessness for 53 years. I also experienced homelessness in the early 1970s, as I mentioned in my testimony a couple weeks ago. Over half of MICA's board and staff are people that experience homelessness or a housing crisis, and 70% of our board of directors are people from diverse communities. MICA and the National Coalition work to ensure people who've experienced homelessness, housing crisis, and or discrimination are at every decision-making table, and that we want to love and treat other people the way that we'd want to be treated. Our MICA members address the immediate needs of people in the community as we work together to change the structural causes of homelessness and end homelessness to realize our mission to ensure that everyone, without exception, has a safe, decent home that's affordable to them at the incomes that they have. So the two things that were testified on last meeting was on corrections and homelessness and the COVID-19 response. And so I'm going to briefly touch on both of those areas in my testimony. So again, thank you for the opportunity. As you may recall, a few weeks ago, I provided testimony in discussing a two-page document on the 10 primary reasons for our 5 decades of growing homelessness in this country. As I mentioned earlier, the number one reason is money and resources. If you have money and you have resources, you probably can have housing no matter what the other issues are. So I'm going to tell you a personal story, and it's my story, and it will talk about my lack of personal responsibility for a period in my life and how I became involved in the criminal justice system. So as I indicated last time, I have a criminal history. I struggled with alcoholism for 10 years, from 2002 to 2012. I was sober on and off during that time. Instead of praying, I often turned to the spirits of alcohol to deal with the pain of seeing people that were experiencing homelessness and people dying on our streets. I got hurt over exercising, trying to stay sober, and I was prescribed what was supposed to be a non-narcotic medication. It actually ended up being an opioid. I ended up having a stroke and a seizure, and my disease of alcoholism went into a full rage. I was driving under the influence. I had an accident, and I hurt people, and I now have a felony on my record. I was in Mille Lacs County Jail for a few weeks in 2012, and I served 6 years of probation, which I completed in 2018, and now have 9 years of sobriety. Because I had resources, owned my own home, and had a business, and because I believe that I'm also white, Caucasian, and female, I did not face as many of the collateral consequences that many do who have a felony on their record. I could pay for a bond to get out of jail, to have my own private attorney, had money in jail to make phone calls. I had money to pay fines to get treatment for 70 days at Hazleton and have outpatient, and I had a home. This is not true for many people who, like me, have a felony, like the gentleman that testified last week who had a traumatic brain injury, but have limited resources and limited other supports. They struggle to get into housing with a criminal record and to get a job, even though we passed legislation that banned the box on employment for them several years ago. So if we're going to really prevent people from the criminal justice from becoming homeless, as you saw on the data that was presented last week, is that we have a large portion of folks that come out of the criminal justice that do end up being homeless. We need a criminal justice system that's going to work for people with limited resources. We need to limit and reduce fines and fees, which is one of our recommendations from the Second Chance Coalition, help people while they're in jail and prison address their issues and struggles, develop the skills for jobs when they're released, and provide another chance as they're released, which includes affordable housing supports, mentors, resources to help them to be successful. We need to change the data mining systems that we have and give people another chance to correct their past instead of having that held against them for the rest of their lives. So I hope as we're moving forward in preventing homelessness that we look at all of our different systems and how they are feeders into people experiencing homelessness. So briefly, I'm just going to talk about the COVID-19 response that we've had in Minnesota and some of the challenges that we still have. We were very happy to see the state respond to my many calls and probably other people's calls in mid-February of 2020. I made many calls to the governor's office, to Kathy Tenbrook, to commissioners, and other folks about developing a plan to assist people experiencing homelessness during the COVID-19 pandemic. As being a provider and being in the field for 53 years, I ran transitional housing in the mid-80s for people that were part of the HIV/AIDS epidemic that we had at that time. So I knew how quickly things can spread throughout our different systems. We have been honored to work with Minnesota Department of Health and Minnesota Interagency on Homelessness and Housing Finance Agency and Health and Human Services in weekly COVID-19 webinar calls addressing the needs of people experiencing homelessness and COVID-19. These calls have been occurring since March 20 and included people that experienced homelessness, providers and advocates, as we are dealing with the crises of people that are struggling with at risk of being homeless and being homeless. And we have the opportunity to provide input and questions, any comments, and it's been very helpful. Obviously, the $100 million that we used of the CARES funding for prevention was very helpful, as well as many communities used portions of their CARES dollars for that. We used $26.5 million in the ESP COVID dollars that the state used directed in March of last year, plus we used CARES money and the governor's initiative. So we had all over $50 million available for emergency services during this last year under COVID-19. Now, when many of us were able to stay at home during the stay-at-home order, as has been mentioned before, people without a home didn't have a place to go. And so MICA and Freedom from the Streets conducted twice a week meetings and have been doing it for the last 11 months with Zoom calls with county commissioners and staff people at Hennepin and Ramsey County and with the interagency to talk about the critical needs of people experiencing homelessness. And that meant where they could eat, where they could sit, where they could go to the bathroom, because all those things closed up when we had the stay-at-home order. And so, again, we had many people that ended up in encampments. And so, obviously, this is an issue that we need to continue to address, is making sure that as we are addressing the COVID-19 response, is that we remember all the folks that are here in Minnesota. If you haven't had a chance to look at the COVID-19 toolkit for shelters and drop-in centers, I will include that in my written testimony that I will also provide the committee. So as we continue to work together on the COVID-19 virus and on isolation and on quarantine spots, we also need to work on the vaccination. And that's a piece of work that, as I mentioned, I'm a consultant on with HUD in providing ways to think about things. One of the things we need to remember is that we have so many different definitions of homelessness in the state as well as nationally. And so we need to use the broadest definition of homelessness so that we are very inclusive of making sure that all people have the opportunity to be vaccinated. The other thing is that we really need to understand that people are really scared about getting vaccinated. There are lots of really crazy stories out there on Facebook and on the internet in regards to the vaccine. So we really need to take time to listen to people, to help them understand about the vaccine. It is a choice because it's under the emergency use authorization. And then we need to help have folks that have experienced homelessness that are willing to get vaccinated to spend time with other folks that are experiencing homelessness to help them feel more comfortable. And so we call those navigators. And so that's something that we're working on here, as well as to have the vaccines happening at places that people feel comfortable in going into, community settings, at the shelters, at the actual encampments, which is the plan that Minnesota currently has. So as we want to meet the immediate needs of people that are experiencing homelessness, we need to constantly keep at our forefront that everyone needs a safe, decent, accessible home that's affordable for them. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have House File 42. This bill was referred to this division by the chair of the full committee, Representative Schultz. Representative Howard, would you like to move your bill to get it before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the bill before the committee.
Representative Howard moves that House File 42 be referred to the Human Services, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Howard, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be brief to give some time to our testifiers, and some of our testifiers have already highlighted the importance of this bill. You know, House File 42 is a bill that acknowledges that by keeping our most vulnerable Minnesotans safe, we're keeping all Minnesotans safe. And this is part of our collective effort during this pandemic to care for our most vulnerable. As has been mentioned, back in March, on a bipartisan basis, Democrats and Republicans came together to support needed funding to keep our most vulnerable safe. And it has been remarkably effective, and there's no doubt that it has saved lives. You know, that sound bipartisan decision that we made in the spring, we did so not knowing the trajectory of this pandemic. And now we find ourselves still in the midst of the pandemic, but these resources are running out. So we absolutely need to take action. You know, these programs, they're our state's safety net, and we cannot allow them to fail. And that is why this is so critical. Together, we took action to save lives back in March, and we need to do so again because time is of the essence. And I'll stop there and turn it over to my testifiers and reserve more time to answer more specific questions about the bill if members have them.
Thank you so much, Representative Howard. We hope to have a good conversation after we hear from a couple of testifiers. First, if Linda Copeland has joined us, you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Gomez and committee members. My name is Linda Copeland. I'm with the CHUM shelter in Duluth, and I'm currently homeless, staying in a hotel setting due to staying safe from COVID. Staying in a hotel has helped me in many different ways. I would first like to mention when the AIDS epidemic hit, I had a dear friend who had AIDS, and they were not able, or hotels were not being discussed at that time, to stay in a hotel, and someone killed him because he had AIDS. I am Afro-American from the baby boomer generation, a senior citizen with a heart attack history. And I, in other words, with the COVID-19 pandemic, I'm a high profile person. The hotel protects me and keeps me safe. And above all, it allows me to focus on my goals, which is housing and getting a part-time job. I would also like to mention that with the hotel, I'm free, or let's just say 99% free of catching germs. Zero people who have stayed in CHUM's hotel have received the have not received the COVID virus. Nursing homes across America, it's a out of control situation with the deaths. And the people from my generation, the baby boomers, are dying like flies because they're finding that the workers are carrying the disease because they don't know that the person they're helping has the pandemic, and then they go treat someone else in the nursing home that has the disease. So once again, I go back to the hotel. It's been a lifesaver for me. If I were not in a hotel, I probably would be dead because you have a lot of people that didn't want to wear a mask. A lot of people, since I am high profile, Afro-American and old, it's, well, she probably has COVID, and that would be very negative for me. So again, I say the hotel has saved my life, and I can honestly say to you that I do believe that if I were not in the hotel, knowing all of my circumstances, I would be dead today. I am able to work on my goals thanks to CHUM. They have a highly knowledgeable, supportive staff. I'm able to work on getting housing, and I look forward to eventually, within 30 to 40 more days, moving into my own place and working as a child care helper. So even though I have a negative profile, it will turn into something very positive. I am in favor of House File 42 and House File 315 for ESP. Shelter saves lives and housing ends homelessness. I appreciate so much from my heart what you're doing and what your committee is doing to combat homelessness. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Ms. Copeland, and we'll all be thinking good thoughts for you as you transition to permanent housing. So glad to hear that. Just for the record, Ms. Copeland was with Churches United in Ministry. That's what CHUM stands for, and it's in Duluth, Minnesota. Next, joining the committee, we have Reed Olson. you could state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me to speak today. My name is Reed Olson. I am a Beltrami County Commissioner. I live in Bemidji. For the record, I'll also say that I'm really active at the Association of Minnesota Counties, and I sit on the EMC Workforce and Economic Development Subcommittee, Workforce Housing and Economic Development Subcommittee. So I am the executive director of the Nameless Coalition for the Homeless, and we are a nonprofit in Bemidji that operates the Wolf Shelter, which is an emergency overnight shelter here in Bemidji, and that's where I'm speaking to you from today. You can see some of the beds behind me. We've used the emergency ESP funding over the past year to relocate at the end of our season. We operate seasonally right now, and at the end of last season, which we finish in May, but for the month of October, of April, we operated out of a hotel here in Bemidji. For various reasons, it didn't really work out for us, and we moved back to our shelter. Since we've moved back here, because of safety concerns and trying to make sure that people are wearing masks and socially distancing properly here inside the shelter, we've had to double our staff. We've had a difficult time retaining staff. We haven't really been fully staffed all year. One of the ways that we've been able to retain the staff that we do have is through having some hazard pay for them. And even that isn't enough. I've lost three people in the last month. I just found out last night that my most senior employee here that's been with us since we opened in February 2016 is leaving for a day job. You know, we're open overnight. It's a very, we work with people that have some fairly profound issues, whether it's substance use disorder or mental health issues. I should say we're a singles shelter. We're not a family shelter. And so it's a very demanding job. And if it wasn't for the accelerated pay, we wouldn't have any staff here, I don't think, at all. Because even with it, we're losing people. We've also been looking at trying to open up. We were open on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. Up here, it was very cold those days. And we really worry about, as was mentioned earlier, because of COVID, the public places where people used to go to, whether it's for bathroom facilities or just to a warming place, the library, the county buildings, they're less receptive to people coming in and hanging out during the day. So they've really lost a lot of their places to stay during the day. So we opened up on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, as I said. I'm looking at opening up this weekend because it's going to be, I think, the high on Saturday and Sunday here in Bemidji. The straight temp high is about 13 below each day. And my biggest concern is always on Sundays. I don't know where people are going to go during the day because there's no public spaces for them. So we'll probably be opening up. And these are all unbudgeted costs for us. It's a strain on our staff. And anytime you have a situation where staff members are leaving, then it puts more strain on the staff that is remaining. They have to pick up the extra duties. And so it puts a tremendous pressure on them. I'm always trying to find new staff. So I guess I'm going to keep this fairly short. The funds that we've been able to get through the ESG grants has really been able to keep us open, keeping people safe. We've had one guest that did contract COVID, and we've had one staff member that has contracted COVID. But because of the protocols that we have in place, we've been able to keep everybody safe, and it's never spread through the shelter, which is really good. Just in closing, I just want to say an immediate increase in funding will allow organizations like ours to continue to operate. It's really important that this isn't part of the end of the session, but that it's immediate, that it's now, because I'm looking at March, not knowing whether or not I'm going to be able to continue the hazard pay with my staff. And if that happens, I'm going to lose my entire staff. So please pass House File 42 and the other Bill 315. And thank you so very much for your time. And I'll more than happy to answer any questions if anyone has any for me.
Thank you, you, Mr. Olson. We've received written testimony on this bill, which has been posted to the committee page and shared with members via email. We also have a few other folks, public testifiers, who've signed up to speak about this bill. First, we're going to go to Director Tenbrook.
Thank you very much, Chair Gomez and members. The majority of my testimony I did earlier, but I did want to just reiterate the points I made about the three legs of the stool that this bill represents in our response on homelessness during this critical time. I know lots of people have talked about the emergency services program, so I won't go into enormous detail there, but just to remind that that has been the critical vehicle to get resources out to community partners, like you just heard from our testifiers on the safe spaces and the hazard pay and the hygiene and the food, et cetera. One thing we haven't talked as much about is the critical work that was done with housing support. And early in the pandemic response, the legislature authorized about $5.5 million to make sure that we could really sustain people's room and board in our housing support program statewide and really make sure to follow the federal and health guidance around COVID. Housing support program in Minnesota provides room and board and related supports for a little more than 21,000 people each month across the state. It serves adults with disabilities and older adults with the goal of preventing and ending homelessness, of course, and also institutionalization. And so this work has the dollars that went to these programs did so many things. And, you know, the PPE and the health supports and safety protocols were high up in the requests from our housing support providers. But also being able to even safely isolate, create spaces on site within those programs where people could recover from COVID if they got sick. And then really critical staffing costs, hiring the staff needed, hazard pay, replacing staff when they got sick. So the things that really kept these programs afloat, and lots of information from providers across the state that say, you know, they otherwise don't know that they could have survived the programming that they were providing to really vulnerable Minnesotans without those resources. So this would be about bolstering that to sustain that same work. And then finally, the remainder is the isolation space. The bill really is around just sustaining the spaces we have. So far, we have been able to provide isolation space to anybody experiencing homelessness who didn't have a safe place to isolate on their own. And so just keeping that going through this fiscal year, of course, is a really important part of this work. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Director Tenbrook. Next, we're going to hear from Dave Dunn. Welcome to the committee. You could state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, I'm Dave Dunn. I am the housing director for Olmsted County. I actually have just a couple of slides, if I could share them with you. I promise it will be my 2-minute PowerPoint presentation, if that's possible. There we go. And so, first of all, just I want to thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for allowing me to come and speak today on behalf of the work that's being done in Rochester and Olmsted County and in support of House File 42. We're also here. We supported House File 21 as well. So as we're kind of going back and forth, we're just glad to be here. But I want to just tell you a little bit about kind of our story in Rochester and Olmsted County. We have been able to use the ESP funds to effectively stand up some services in our community that provided a safe place for people to be during the pandemic, which worked out extraordinarily well with shelter, with a place to be during the day, with hotels for those who are the most vulnerable. What we found, in spite of our best efforts, was on December 1st, we found out that we were having some staffing shortages with our homeless service provider community because of COVID. And shortly by the middle of the day, December 2nd, we had found out that we had a homeless population had a COVID outbreak. And so what we were able to do and what we needed to do was very quickly be able to stand up some alternative care facilities for those who were sick to provide continued support and shelter for those who were not. And with help from the ESP funds, what we were able to do is within a matter of about 48 hours, stand up the Mayo Civic Center as kind of an emergency shelter location in Rochester so we could provide people with that safe place to be. And that would not be possible without these funds. And I hope that we don't have a second wave hit us, but I'm also think we need to be prepared for that if it occurs. And if so, having, you know, that ability for us to safely and quickly be able to transition people into safe locations is going to be very necessary. Also, just briefly, you know, I think that the two House files that we're talking about today really build that system. My three-legged stool is slightly different than Director Tenbrook's, but I think it's really the same kind of concepts here, and that we really need to be providing shelter, the services, and the housing. And I think in order for us to be successful, we need all three. And so as we know, you know, the ultimate goal is not shelter. The ultimate goal is not the services. The ultimate goal is to get people to thrive and to get people to self-sufficiency and to meet their potential as quickly as possible and to also meet their individualized needs. And so that's really, you know, at Olmsted County, that's what we're trying to do. That's our goal. These two files, they help us meet that goal. And I just want to close with one last slide, because I think it's important that we also talk about some of the fiscal impacts of what it is that maybe we invest in as a state. And these are some of the costs. I was able to pull this together yesterday from some of our other departments within Olmsted County and with some support from the school district here. You can see that our daily cost per person for detox is $400 a night or a day. The adult detention center is $200. Student transportation for someone who's experiencing homelessness for the next town over is $60 a day, and it gets higher up as you go further away from Rochester. A hotel voucher is about $55, shelter is $41, and then rental assistance is $18. And so I guess what I would ask on behalf of Olmsted County and the populations that we work with is that let's, you know, if we focus those investments on that bottom part of the chart, that we can have better outcomes. And frankly, I believe that it's also more fiscally responsible and efficient as well. So with that, I'll thank you for your time today, and I'll stop sharing my screen and close my testimony.
Thank you so much for that, Mr. Dunn. I appreciate the kind of accounting for what it means, if you know what the kind of different investments mean. Next, we're going to hear from Commissioner Patrick Boyle. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Boyle, if you would state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for letting me speak. My name is Patrick Boyle, and I'm the sitting St. Louis County Commissioner representing East Duluth for the past 8 years. I'm also representing the Association of Minnesota Counties today in support of House File 42 and 21. And I just want to mention a couple things. First off is the myth that short-term housing is predominantly a issue that deals with Minneapolis and St. Paul. This is false. It directly affects rural and urban areas the same. And St. Louis County is just a perfect example of this. With half our population of 200,000 living in what the late great representative and commissioner Tom Rukavina used to call the South 40 acres, and the other part of the population moving north through townships and cities through the range to the Canadian border, we are the true urban-rural partnership. As of yesterday, February 2nd, St. Louis County coordinated entry data showed that 1,273 people in Duluth and 160 in northern St. Louis County were currently waiting for housing. Our short-term housing is currently at 100% full, and we have 14-plus months of waiting list for permanent housing. And we know these folks are coming from the Arrowhead region, from International Falls to Grand Marais. Much like our previous speakers from Bemidji and Rochester, Duluth is primarily a hub, especially during this pandemic, for healthcare and nonprofit needs. We are currently averaging 34 people staying at our warming shelter per night in January. And I know that we'll be saving lives over this next week with the cold streak that's going to be coming. Number two is cost effectiveness. Through the help from the state, St. Louis County partnered to build Steve O'Neill Apartments just around 7 years ago. This is transitional housing dedicated to helping single parents, not with a handout, but with a hand up approach. With social services offered on site, parents are educated on being good parents, getting a GED, getting a job, getting off probation. And I can tell you firsthand, the first 5 years, 308 families have successfully graduated using this program, not needing county and state services anymore. This is what we need to do as a state. In closing, I just want to thank the legislature. Being an elected official, I know we get asked what's wrong with what we're doing, but I just want to put out what you guys have done right. And with that was the added emphasis on mental health. And I especially want to single out Senator Senjum, who I worked with in his bills with mental health in the past. Currently, the Arrowhead region is building a regional mental health crisis center to help those folks across the Arrowhead, along with permanent housing, 30-plus units, to house those hardest to house with mental health and substance use. I figure that these house files are more the same. It's not a Republican issue with transitional housing. It's not a Democrat issue. It's a Minnesota issue. And I look forward to working with you guys in the future to push this through. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Commissioner. We've heard a lot about the Steve O'Neill House. We'll have to kind of have a more complete overview of what you guys do there at some point. So we're going to move into discussion. I know that I wanted to go back to Representative Ryer. I'm really sorry that we weren't able to take your comment or your question on Rep. Hassan's bill. Do you want to go ahead, Representative Ryer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to speak on behalf of both of the bills we're hearing today because I know from my own life, from the lives of many people around me, from the testimony of people on this and other committees, what a difference it makes. And in thinking about, you know, we can do things to help people and mitigate the immediate situation, but then we can look at the preventive. And one thing that I want to give due weight to is the healthcare system and in particular mental health, other disabilities, and the impact that that has in terms of how people end up losing their home, losing their shelter, and facing homelessness. So I think as we're looking at a comprehensive solution, we need to be thinking about those pieces in addition to the loss of affordable housing, the increases in housing prices, the internal factors for the individual as well as the external factors. And I think thinking about those helps address the good question that Representative Petersburg raised on what are the root causes so that we can find solutions that are profound in their reach and really get at the core of the issues we're facing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Ryer. Next up is Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much, Commissioner Boyle, for your testimony. I was just going through, it just popped up on my Facebook feed that today that it was 6 years ago today that we dedicated the Steve O'Neill Apartments, so in honor of our mutual friend. And, you know, my question is, and I think that was the state support for that was primarily through the bonding bill. But I'm wondering, you know, Commissioner, if you have any thoughts about, you know, the best way for us as a legislature to replicate that model statewide. You know, that has been something that, you know, I've talked to a number of people about. And I think, you know, your testimony and others have really suggested that. And so, what would your advice be, you know, to, you know, really create that model in many, many other communities?
You know, thank you, Representative, and I always remember your speech during Steve's passing was one of the better speeches I've ever heard. But short and sweet, the long run, it's a partnership. It was with St. Louis County, it was with the city of Duluth, it was with the state, along with our nonprofits. You know, we have CHUM running it 24/7. We have Center City Housing that is running the building as a whole, brick and mortar. It's a partnership like that. It can't just be one entity. It's got to be a community-based, regional-based kind of issue that's really important to electeds and to the general public. And as you can see, it absolutely saves lives, makes them better, and it gets them self-efficient. We have the San Marco model that was used years ago, where it's a wet and dry place for those folks using alcohol. And what a commitment and what time that's been used to make a great analogy of where police were against it at the beginning and now are 100% for it, to get a roof over people's head, to get them the help they need. And so it's absolutely community, state, and to the point federally based, if we can get that, and with our nonprofits and general public. That's how it works.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Representative Hornstein?
No, thank you, Commissioner. I mean, I think that's, you know, it really is a model that works. I'm glad you pointed out how successful it's been, and I hope that we can figure out a way as a state to, you know, we have an important convening role at the state level, as well as everyone at the local level. But I think it would be really useful to, you know, really figure out how we can, you know, just institutionalize this model, because it works.
Thank you very much, Representative. Next up is Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Hornstein and Commissioner, for running through that just a little bit, because I do think that is such a critical piece. Then we have to figure out how to get there. So I really appreciate you calling attention to that. I would also just like to thank Mr. Dunn. I thought that chart that you showed at the end was really, really helpful and shows maybe a little bit where we need to be trying to get with this committee. So that was really helpful, and I appreciate that. My first question is, you know, to date, since this is a COVID relief package, I want to stick to that issue. My question is, to date, I believe that between the two, I think we appropriated $32 million from the legislature to COVID relief. And then the governor appropriated out of the COVID funds another six something million during the COVID emergency. My question is, and I don't know if this is for you, Representative Howard, or if you want to phone a friend, do we have a good solid accounting of where that money went and exactly how it was used? Was it used primarily for, you know, the four, it looks like we're spending about $4.8 million a month on the emergency services. Is that going primarily to pay staff, to keep, make sure that we have staff to fund these folks? Is that primarily hotel vouchers? Do we have a good accounting right now of where all that money is gone?
Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Representative Howard, or Director Tenbrook, I assume might have some info to share with us. Or again, you know, as I mentioned, one of the pieces of the financial overview that we've asked the Director Tenbrook staff to prepare for us is about an accounting of the way that the COVID response money, both the money allocated by the state and the money received by the feds, was dispersed. But I'll let you guys go ahead. Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, I believe we do have a good sense of how those dollars were utilized, but I will turn it over to Ms. Tenbrook, who could speak to it much better than me.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Chair Gomez and Representative Brindley. It's a wonderful question. Yes, we do. We can give the exact breakdown of where all of those dollars went in terms of staffing, hygiene, sanitation supplies, food, PPE, and all of that. So we can get the details of that. I will just at a high level say it was $26.5 million right at the beginning of the pandemic, from the legislature that really, I'm so grateful for that bipartisan support, that really kicked off a very effective response statewide. And then there was an additional $19.5 million from the federal COVID relief fund dollars that came to sustain and build on that work. And we do have that broken down by every type of activity that people apply for. So we can certainly give that to the committee.
Thank you, Director Tenbrook. Representative New Brindley, we have 5 minutes left in our committee, and as I said, we're going to do a financial overview moving forward. So if you have other questions, but we also have Rep. Heinrich in queue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, then I guess I will just, since we just have 5 minutes, I'll just ask one more question. I am concerned that, you know, this is a COVID relief bill. Is there a reason that you did not have a clawback if we do receive additional COVID relief funds that they would reimburse the general fund? We all know, obviously, we are not in a strong fiscal position as a state at this moment. There's a strong likelihood that we'll be getting additional COVID relief funds from the federal government. Is there a reason that you chose not to include that clawback?
Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, Representative New Brindley, I'm open to that discussion on that point, but I'll just call attention, the last federal package did not include any resources for this vein, but that has been part of the discussion. It was part of the discussion back in December when ultimately we were not able to move forward because the Senate caucus didn't want to pursue this, but open to that discussion as the bill moves forward.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you. Just very quickly, and that COVID relief fund is largely spent at the governor's discretion. So there's no reason that we couldn't claw that back to the general fund. I think that would certainly be the responsible thing to do. I appreciate your openness on that. I'm going to be a no vote on this today, but I hope that we can get some things worked out on that and figure out exactly. Like, it's difficult that we're having the financial overviews after these bills. Those would certainly be helpful for these particular bills, but thank you.
Thank you. Representative Heinrich.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question for Representative Howard on the bill, specifically Section 1, lines 1.9, 1.1. And it just seems like the language is pretty broad. I'm just looking for some clarification from you, Representative Howard. When we talk about the isolated individuals and isolation spaces, is that a term for what, in your mind, is that a hotel or motel room? Or are we talking about manufacturing some sort of an isolation space inside of an existing shelter? I guess that's my first question.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the values of these dollars is they are flexible to meet the needs of the community. But in by and large, I believe that's how they've been utilized to purchase a place in hotel rooms, like we heard from Ms. Copeland, and have been very effective at helping provide safety to our unsheltered community while also keeping them safe from COVID and isolated.
Representative Heinrich, we have 2 minutes left in the committee, just FYI.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more quick question, just in regard, I'm not going to ask my second question. I understand that we want to make sure that this is broad enough, I suppose, to help different people. My other issue, I suppose, had to do with the respiratory illness. Anybody experiencing respiratory illness, in my mind, that could be anybody with asthma, for one example, individuals exposed to COVID-19. So apparently, you know, you don't have to have COVID-19. You could be exposed, which could mean any number of things. I think there's a good chance probably all of us have certainly been exposed. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the time.
Thank you, Representative Heinrich. Representative Howard, did you have any final comments you wanted to share with the committee before we vote on?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I know I'll be brief with my 1 minute here. And just more than anything, I want to thank the testifiers, but especially Ms. Copeland, for sharing her story and her perspective. You know, she said that with this legislation in place, she believes that it saved her life. And I just want to thank her and tell Ms. Copeland that your testimony is going to help save the lives of others if we move forward with this bill. And lastly, I think we've had a good discussion, but I want to be clear that this bill should really be the bare minimum. Protecting our most vulnerable during a global pandemic, that should be a given of this legislature. And so I'm hopeful that we can move forward on a bipartisan basis as we did in March. And then I did just want to comment on the discussion we had a little bit about, this is a little more broad, but I think it's a little dangerous to go down the road of saying that the primary cause of homelessness is personal choices. I think we need to acknowledge that homelessness is a result of system failure. And unless we do that, we're not going to solve homelessness. And, you know, Minnesotans don't choose to be homeless. Just to tick off a few examples, folks are homeless sometimes because they had to lose wages or a job to care for a loved one. Well, there's a policy response. We can create paid family leave. Folks become homeless because they get sick. We can have a better healthcare system that doesn't allow a health illness to drive you to bankruptcy. We already heard about wages that are going stagnant while rent is increases. We can increase wages and we can build more affordable housing to help drive down the cost of rent. Domestic violence is often a reason why women face homelessness. We can support survivors and take on toxic masculinity in a number of ways. We've already heard about our mental health care system. We don't really have one. We need to create a stronger mental health care system. There's opportunity gaps in our schools that manifest before children make it to kindergarten. We can invest in pre-K and equitable child care for all. And folks who do become evicted for one of these reasons will have an eviction on their record for years and years, which often prevents them from attaining stable housing. We can take on and reform our processes as well. And so I just think I appreciate the discussion on that front, and I feel like it sort of gives us a mission in this committee for the kinds of system change work that we want to do and center. And this bill is a small part of it. It should be the bare minimum. And I look forward to passing this bill and the greater work we're going to do in this committee over this session. So with that, Madam Chair, I will move House Bill 42, to be moved to the Human Services Committee.
Thank you. Representative Howard renews his motion that House File 42 be referred back to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. The Legislative Assistant will take the roll.
Chair Gomez.
Aye.
Chair Gomez, aye. Keeler.
Aye.
Keeler, aye. New Brindley.
No.
New Brindley, nay. Davids.
No.
Davids, nay. Heinrich.
No.
Heinrich, nay. Hollins.
Aye.
Hollins, aye. Hornstein.
Aye.
Hornstein, aye. Howard.
Aye.
Howard, aye. Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Petersburg.
No.
Petersburg, no. Ryer.
Aye.
Ryer, aye. 7 ayes and 4 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 4 nays, Representative Howard, House File 42 is on its way to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Briefly, before we adjourn, members, I wanted to let you know that Chair Fu Lee has invited members of the Preventing Homelessness Division and the Housing Committee to join Capital Investment for a hearing on housing infrastructure bonds. The Capital Investment meeting is Tuesday, February 9th at 8:30 a.m., and details will be coming to us in the next few days from the Committee Administrator for Capital Investment. And I hope we're all able to make that conversation. And with that, members, we are adjourned.